A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the conversation nobody wants to have at dinner. We've talked about housing before, but this cuts to something deeper. He's pointing out that the housing crisis has shape-shifted. It used to mean homelessness, people on the street, addiction, social services territory. Now it's a systemic societal problem that's swallowing the middle class. And his question is, if we accept that lifelong renting is the new normal, what happens when you stop earning? When you're 80 and the rent is still due and your income is a pension that might not cover it? He wants us to look at places that have actually made this workable. Governments that have normalized renting as a lifelong, dignified option, including the retirement and end-of-life part that nobody wants to think about.
That retirement part is where the whole rental subscription analogy just collapses. Paying for housing like you pay for email works fine when you're earning. Predictable service, predictable cost. But email doesn't become unaffordable when you stop working. And unlike a mortgage that eventually ends, rent is a permanent line item on a fixed income budget. That's the cliff.
It's almost like we've sleepwalked into treating housing as a subscription without ever designing the cancellation policy. You can cancel Netflix. You can't cancel shelter.
And the subscription model assumes you'll always have the same income, or that the service will always cost roughly the same. Neither is true for housing over a 30-year retirement. So let's unpack why the retirement problem is the one that keeps housing policy experts up at night.
Before we get to the numbers, I want to sit with Daniel's framing for a second, because he's not just asking a policy question, he's asking a life question. When he talks about the sole surviving tenant, the person who outlives their partner and faces the last years alone in a rental, he's naming something that's going to happen to millions of people, and I think most of them haven't done the math.
They haven't. And here's the number that should make everyone uncomfortable. In 2025, the homeownership rate for Americans aged 65 and up was 79%, which sounds fine until you flip it. 21% of seniors are renters. That's up from 18% in 2010. And the trend line is not pointing toward more ownership. It's pointing toward more people hitting 65 with no equity, no paid-off house, and a rent check due every month.
21% of 65-plus Americans. That's millions of people staring at that cliff right now. And the trend is accelerating. What's driving that shift?
Later marriage, later childbearing, student debt delaying first home purchases, the run-up in home prices since 2020 that locked a lot of people out permanently. But the biggest factor is simply that wages haven't kept pace with home prices. In 2000, the median home price was about 4 times median household income. In 2025, it's closer to 6 times. That gap represents millions of people who would have been owners a generation ago and are now permanent renters.
They're already struggling. The median U.S. renter over 65 spends 32% of their income on housing, compared to 18% for homeowners the same age. That's 2024 census data. And 32% is the median. Half of them are spending more. Some much more.
Let me put a face on that number. Imagine a 68-year-old woman in Phoenix. She's widowed, worked as a medical records clerk her whole career, has a modest pension and Social Security totaling about $2,800 a month. Her rent for a one-bedroom is $1,400. That's 50% of her income just on housing, before food, before medication, before transportation. And Phoenix rents have been rising at about 4% annually. In 5 years, that same apartment could be $1,700. Now she's at 60%.
That's while she's still alive and presumably functional. The prompt's question about the sole surviving tenant, the person who outlives their partner and faces the last years alone in a rental. That's not a hypothetical. That's the demographic reality. More single-person households in old age, more renters, and no policy framework for what happens when the subscription outlasts the subscriber's ability to pay.
The Phoenix example isn't even a worst case. In Miami, the median senior renter spends over 40% of income on housing. In Los Angeles, it's similar. These are not edge cases. This is the lived experience of a growing share of the elderly population.
Let's do this properly. To understand the retirement cliff, we first need to look at the numbers. What does a lifetime of renting actually cost compared to owning?
Because the first pushback Daniel mentioned is the unavoidable one, rent is dead money. You pay it, it's gone, you never recoup it. And that criticism might have an answer if rents were affordable and controlled. But we need to see if the math actually supports that.
I want to flag something before we dive in. The dead money argument has this moral weight to it. It's not just a financial calculation. It's the idea that renting is somehow a failure of adulthood, that you're throwing money away because you didn't plan properly. We need to test whether that holds up.
Let's use Austin, Texas as our case study. It's a city that saw both a rental boom and a construction boom, so the numbers are recent and real. In the fourth quarter of 2025, median rent in Austin was about $1,850 a month. The median mortgage payment for a new buyer, principal, interest, taxes, insurance, was about $2,400.
Renting looks cheaper month to month, $600 less. That's real money. You could invest that difference.
Here's where the dead money argument bites. Over 30 years, that $1,850 in rent. Assuming it tracks inflation at roughly 3% annually, totals somewhere around $1.1 million paid to a landlord. You owe nothing at the end. The mortgage, at $2,400 a month, fixed for 30 years, totals about $860,000. And at the end, you own an asset that's likely appreciated.
The raw numbers favor owning by about $250,000, plus the value of the house itself. Case closed, right?
That's too simple, because ownership comes with costs renters don't pay. Property taxes in Texas are high. Austin's effective rate is around 1.8%. On a $400,000 home, that's $7,200 a year. Over 30 years, that's over $200,000 just in property tax. Then there's maintenance. The rule of thumb is 1% of home value annually, so another $4,000 a year, another $120,000 over 30 years. Insurance, another $50,000 to $80,000. Transaction costs when you buy and sell, realtor commissions, closing costs, easily another $30,000 to $40,000.
You're adding nearly $400,000 in ownership costs that renters don't pay. And here's the thing about maintenance. The 1% rule is an average. Some years you spend nothing. Then year 7, the HVAC dies and you're writing a $12,000 check. Year 15, the roof needs replacing. These are lumpy, unpredictable expenses that can wreck a retiree's budget.
Suddenly, that $860,000 mortgage plus $400,000 in ownership costs puts you at about $1.26 million over 30 years, and the renter paid $1.1 million. The gap narrows dramatically. In high-cost markets, it can actually flip. Renting and investing the difference can outperform buying.
The rent is dead money. Line is only partly true. Ownership is dead money, too. It's just buried in taxes, maintenance, and interest. The real difference is the asset at the end. But that asset only matters if you can access its value without selling and moving, which most people can't.
Which brings us back to the retirement cliff. The homeowner who paid off their mortgage has eliminated their single largest monthly expense. They still pay property tax and maintenance, but those are fractions of what rent would be. Still paying full freight, until they die.
That's where the psychological dimension kicks in. It's not just math. It's the difference between knowing you have a place that's yours, that nobody can take away as long as you pay the taxes, versus knowing that your continued occupancy depends on a monthly payment that might outpace your income.
There's been research on this. The anxiety of perpetual obligation in old age is real and measurable. Homeowners report higher life satisfaction in retirement, not just because they're wealthier, but because of the security. The knowledge that even if everything else goes wrong, the roof over your head is secure.
I think about my own grandmother, who owned her house free and clear. She had very little income, social security, and a tiny pension from a secretarial job. But she never worried about where she'd live. The house was hers. She could be broke at the end of the month and still have her home. That's a form of security that transcends the balance sheet.
That's exactly the feeling that lifelong renters are denied. Not because they made worse choices, increasingly because they were born into a different housing market, which is why Daniel's question is so pointed. If we're going to normalize lifelong renting, we have to answer for that anxiety. We can't just say rent is fine and hand wave the last 20 years of someone's life.
That's where the policy models come in. Because some countries have actually answered this question, they've built systems where renting into your 80s and 90s isn't a crisis waiting to happen. Let's look at three of them.
If the economics are this brutal, who's actually solved this?
Vienna is the one everyone cites, and for good reason. I've seen the photos. These aren't the housing projects that come to mind when Americans hear public housing. We're talking about buildings with courtyards, with architectural detail, with the kind of quality that would rent at a premium in a private market.
62% of Viennese residents live in subsidized housing, either municipal housing owned by the city or limited profit housing associations. And this isn't grim Soviet-style blocks. These are well-maintained, architecturally varied buildings with gardens, balconies, community spaces. The system was established in 1923 and has survived fascism, war, and multiple political regime changes. That institutional resilience alone tells you something.
1923. That's over a century of continuous operation. What's the mechanism for retirees?
Two key things. First, lifetime tenancy. Once you're in, you're in. Your lease doesn't expire. You can't be evicted because a landlord wants to renovate and raise rents. Second, there's a program called Wohnbeihilfe. Housing assistance, specifically designed for pensioners. If you're over 65 and your rent exceeds 20% of your pension income, the city covers the gap. In 2025, Vienna spent 1.2 billion euros on housing subsidies, with 220,000 units reserved for seniors at below market rates.
20% of pension income. That's the cap. So a retiree in Vienna knows with certainty that housing will never consume more than a fifth of what they have to live on. That's not just a number. That's peace of mind codified into law.
That certainty is the whole game. It's not just the money, it's the predictability. You can plan the rest of your life around a fixed housing cost. Compare that to the American senior renter spending 32% and wondering if next year's increase pushes it to 40. That uncertainty has real health consequences. Stress, delayed medical care, skipped meals to make rent.
What about the sole surviving tenant scenario? Does Vienna have anything specific for that?
The system includes priority transfers for seniors whose circumstances change. If you're a widow or widower in a three-bedroom unit that's now too large and too expensive, you get priority access to a smaller subsidized unit. You don't lose your place in the system. The city also runs Seniorenwohnhäuser, senior residential homes that are part of the social housing stock, not separate nursing facilities. They're integrated into regular apartment buildings, so you're not segregated from the community.
Integrated aging in place. That's elegant. You're not shipped off to a facility when you become a burden. You just move to a smaller unit in the same system, maybe in the same building, maybe down the street. Your community stays intact. What's the next model?
Completely different approach, but equally interesting for the retirement question. Singapore's Housing Development Board, the HDB, houses about 80% of the population. These are 99-year leasehold apartments that residents buy, not rent. But here's the clever part for retirement. In 2009, they introduced the lease buyback scheme.
How does that work? Because selling part of your lease sounds like you're giving up something. Most people don't want to give up housing security.
When you turn 65, you can sell part of your remaining lease back to the government. The government pays you a lump sum, and you continue living in the apartment. The amount depends on how many years are left on the lease and the flat's value. In 2024, 15,000 households used this scheme, with an average payout of 120,000 Singapore dollars, roughly 90,000 US dollars. In 2024, they expanded it to allow partial lease sellbacks, so you don't have to sell the whole remaining term. You can sell just enough to top up your retirement income.
It's a way to convert housing equity into retirement income without moving. You stay put. The government essentially buys your apartment from your estate in advance. And the partial option is key. You're not betting your entire housing future. You're just converting, say, 10 years of your remaining lease into cash while keeping enough term to likely outlive you.
And it solves the problem that homeowners in other countries face, being house rich and cash poor. you're sitting on a $1 million asset but can't afford groceries. Singapore's scheme lets you eat your house, metaphorically speaking, without losing your home.
Singapore's model is mostly ownership-based.
Right. Singapore is less directly applicable to the rental question. But the principle is transferable, a mechanism that converts housing tenure into retirement income without displacement. For a rental system, the equivalent would be a government-backed rental subsidy that kicks in at retirement age, indexed to pension income. Vienna essentially does this.
Which brings us to the third model.
And this one is directly about renting. Sweden has a system called hyresrätt, literally rental right. Tenants have indefinite leases. Rents are not set by the market. They're set through annual collective bargaining between the tenants' union and the landlords, mostly municipal housing companies and private landlords. The system is called Bruksvärdessystemet, the utility value system. Rents are based on the apartment's practical value, size, location, amenities, building quality, not on what the market would bear.
Rents are decoupled from market pressure entirely. If a neighborhood gets trendy, the landlord can't cash in on that. The rent reflects the physical characteristics of the unit, not the desirability of the zip code.
And for retirees, there's Bostad Stillegg, a housing supplement paid through the state pension system. If your rent exceeds a certain threshold relative to your income, the supplement covers the difference. In 2025, 350,000 pensioners received Bostad Stillegg, with an average monthly supplement of 4,500 Swedish kronor, about $420.
350,000 pensioners in a country of 10.5 million people. That's a significant portion of the elderly population, and it's administered through the pension system, not through a separate welfare agency. That's a deliberate design choice.
It normalizes the idea that housing assistance in old age is not charity. It's part of the pension system. Just like you get a base pension, you get a housing top-up if you need it. There's no stigma attached. You're not going to a welfare office and proving you're poor enough to deserve help. It's automatic based on income data the state already has.
That's a profound difference. In the US, housing assistance requires you to perform poverty. You have to document your insufficiency. Sweden just says, here's your pension, and if your rent is high relative to that, here's the supplement.
Let's pull out the common threads here. All three models share four principles. 1. Rent or housing cost is tied to income, not to market rates. 2. Tenure is effectively permanent. You can't be displaced because a landlord wants to cash in. 3. The state provides a dedicated housing supplement for retirees that kicks in when housing costs exceed a reasonable share of pension income. 4. There's some mechanism to convert housing value into retirement income without forcing a move. Singapore's lease buyback, Vienna's priority transfers, Sweden's supplement.
Number 4 is the one that's completely absent from the American conversation. We have Section 8 vouchers for low-income renters, but nothing designed for the middle-class retiree who rented their whole life, has some savings, but can't sustain market-rate rent on a fixed income for 20 or 30 years of retirement. These are people who did everything right. Worked, saved, paid their rent on time, and the system still has no answer for them.
The prompt asked about making lifelong renting workable. These models suggest it's possible, but they all require something that the United States and most English-speaking countries don't have, a housing system where the government is a major player, not just a regulator of private markets.
That's the political feasibility question. These systems took decades to build. Vienna started in 1923. Sweden's rent negotiation system was established in the 1960s. Singapore's HDB began in 1960, and the lease buyback scheme didn't arrive until 2009. These are multi-generational projects. They weren't built in one election cycle.
Which raises the obvious question. Is any of this transferable to a country that didn't have a social democratic moment in the mid-20th century that built these institutions? The U.S. had the New Deal and the Great Society, but housing was never the centerpiece the way it was in Vienna or Singapore.
What can be implemented in the current political climate? Because telling an American audience just rebuild Vienna's century-old social housing infrastructure isn't actionable. That's not a policy proposal. It's a history lesson.
Let me offer three things that are actually plausible. First, rent stabilization tied to income rather than to an arbitrary percentage. Germany's Mietpreisbremse, The rent price break, CAPS, increases at 15% over 3 years in tight markets. It's not as strong as Vienna or Sweden, but it's a functional model that exists in a market economy with private landlords. It could be adapted to include an income-indexed cap for seniors specifically.
You'd have a two-tier system, standard rent control for everyone, and an additional protection for retirees that caps their rent as a percentage of pension income. The landlord still gets paid, but the excess above, say, 25% of income is covered by a public fund.
Second, lifetime tenure protections. In Germany, indefinite leases are the norm. A landlord can't refuse to renew a lease without specific grounds. Wanting to raise the rent isn't one of them. That's a legal change, not a construction project. It could be implemented through legislation without building a single unit. A housing supplement for seniors modeled on Sweden's Bostadstillägg. This already partially exists in the U.S. through the Section 8 voucher program, but it's underfunded and stigmatized. The shift would be to reframe it as a universal entitlement for pensioners whose housing costs exceed, say, 30% of income, not a poverty program, a retirement security program.
The reframing is key. Right now, rental assistance in America reads as welfare. Sweden treats it the way we treat Social Security, something you've earned by participating in the system. And Social Security itself was once controversial. People called it socialism. Now it's the third rail of American politics. Touch it and you die. That transformation is possible.
That's where the misconception busting comes in. The standard objection to rent control is that it always leads to housing shortages. Landlords stop building, maintenance declines, black markets emerge. And in a purely market-driven system with no public housing supply, that's often true. But Vienna and Singapore show the counterexample. Income-indexed rent control paired with robust public housing construction works. It doesn't create shortages because the government is also building.
The misconception is that rent control is a standalone policy. It's not. It's one leg of a stool that also needs public supply and tenant protections. Take away any leg and it falls over. Critics of rent control are right when they say it fails in isolation, but they're wrong when they pretend it's always in isolation.
Another misconception, home ownership is always the better financial decision. We just ran the Austin numbers. When you add property tax, maintenance, insurance, and transaction costs, the gap narrows considerably. In San Francisco or New York, with price-to-rent ratios above 30, renting and investing the difference can actually outperform buying over a 30-year period. The real financial advantage of home ownership isn't the monthly cash flow, it's the forced savings mechanism. Most people won't invest the difference between renting and owning. They'll spend it. The mortgage forces them to build equity.
Which is a behavioral argument for ownership, not a mathematical one. It's saying people lack the discipline to make renting work financially. Not that renting is inherently worse. And that's a fair point about human nature. But it's also a solvable problem. Automatic enrollment in retirement accounts, for instance, addresses the same behavioral gap.
The third misconception, this one matters for the emotional core of the episode, is that lifelong renting means you'll die in a rundown apartment. Vienna's social housing disproves that entirely. These are modern, well-maintained units with gardens and community spaces. Seniors get priority access to ground floor units and buildings with elevators. The physical quality of the housing is decoupled from market dynamics.
I think that's worth sitting with for a moment. The quality of your housing in old age shouldn't depend on whether you made a good real estate decision in your 30s. It should be a baseline societal guarantee. We don't make access to clean water depend on whether you invested wisely in your 20s. Housing is just as fundamental.
Which brings us to the actionable part. Those systems took decades and specific political conditions, but there are things you can do right now.
First, and this is genuinely practical, if you're currently renting, model your retirement budget assuming rent continues. Don't assume you'll buy later. Don't assume rent will stay flat. Run the numbers with a 3% annual increase and see what your monthly housing cost looks like at age 70, 75, 80. Then compare that to your projected retirement income.
Most people don't do this. They assume housing will sort itself out. But rent is the single largest line item in most budgets, and it's the one that's most likely to grow faster than inflation. If you're 40 and renting, and your rent is $2,000 a month, at 3% inflation you're looking at over $4,000 a month by the time you're 65. On a fixed income,
That exercise isn't just about scaring yourself. It's about making informed decisions now. Maybe it means prioritizing a move to a lower-cost city while you're still working. Maybe it means accelerating savings to build a cushion specifically for housing costs. Maybe it means considering a career shift that extends your earning years, but you can't plan for what you haven't modeled.
Second actionable item, advocate for specific policies by name. Not affordable housing in the abstract. Income indexed rent stabilization for seniors. Lifetime tenure protections. A housing supplement for pensioners. These exist in other countries, and they have names and track records. The conversation changes when you can say, Sweden's Bostad still egg covers 350,000 pensioners, instead of, we should help seniors with rent.
Third, this addresses the sole surviving tenant scenario directly. Consider co-housing or intentional communities as a private sector solution. This is already happening. Groups of older adults, often women who've outlived spouses, pooling resources to buy or rent shared housing. They get the cost savings of shared expenses, the social benefits of community, and the security of knowing someone will notice if you don't come downstairs for breakfast.
The Golden Girls model.
And it's growing. There are now organizations that facilitate this. Matching older adults looking for shared housing, helping with legal agreements, setting up the framework so it's not just a roommate situation, but an intentional community with mutual support obligations.
It doesn't solve the policy gap, but it's something you can do without waiting for legislation. And it addresses the loneliness dimension, which is the part that pure financial solutions miss. The widow in a two-bedroom rental isn't just facing a cost problem, she's facing isolation. Co-housing tackles both.
Loneliness has real health consequences. Studies show it's as damaging as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So this isn't just about warm feelings, it's about longevity. The social fabric of a shared house might literally add years to your life.
The broader takeaway here, and this goes back to the heart of Daniel's prompt, is that the rental subscription model can work, but only if it includes an end-of-life clause, a mechanism for what happens when the subscription stops being affordable. Right now, the American rental market doesn't have one. Vienna, Singapore, and Sweden do.
The mechanism doesn't have to be identical across countries. Singapore's approach is to help people extract equity they've already built. Sweden's is to supplement income directly. Vienna's is to cap costs as a percentage of income and provide the housing directly. Different tools, same outcome. No one in old age should lose their home because they stopped earning.
Which brings us back to the uncomfortable question we opened with. If we accept lifelong renting as the new normal, do we also accept that some people will die in rented accommodation? And is that inherently undignified?
I think the dignity question depends entirely on the conditions, not the ownership structure. Dying in a well-maintained Vienna municipal apartment with garden access and a community around you, knowing your housing cost is capped at 20% of your pension, that doesn't strike me as undignified. Dying alone in a deteriorating apartment you can barely afford, knowing the rent increase letter could arrive any month, that's a different story.
Dignity isn't about the deed, it's about security, quality, and community.
That's the reframing the policy conversation needs. We've turned home ownership into a proxy for dignity in old age because, in the absence of any other support system, it's the only thing that provides security. If we built the support system, the proxy wouldn't be necessary. You wouldn't need to own your home to feel safe in it.
As the 2026 midterms approach, housing is polling as a top three issue. The question is whether any party will propose something that looks like a lifetime rental framework. Not just first-time buyer assistance, not just down payment subsidies, but a coherent answer to the question of what happens when you're 75 and renting.
I haven't seen it yet. The conversation is still dominated by the ownership pipeline. How do we get young people into houses? But the 21% of seniors who are already renters, and the growing cohort behind them, need an answer that isn't, you should have bought 30 years ago.
The housing crisis isn't just about getting a roof. It's about keeping one, especially when you can no longer pay for it. And that's the part we're still not talking about.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, European sailors reported that cuttlefish could produce a low-frequency hum by vibrating their internal cuttle bone, a sound that traveled through wooden ship hulls and was sometimes mistaken for distant thunder.
A cuttlefish humming through a ship hull? Of course there are. I'm now imagining some terrified 16th century sailor convinced a storm was coming, and it was just a cephalopod.
That's going to sit with me. The idea that for centuries, sailors were hearing cuttlefish and thinking it was weather. There's probably a metaphor in there about mistaking natural phenomena for existential threats, but I'll leave that for another episode.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, for the fact, and for apparently having a deep archive of baffling cephalopod acoustics.
If this episode gave you something to think about, or a reason to run your retirement numbers tonight, please rate and review the show. It helps other people find us.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.